on the phone right now. I'm so excited about this, and everybody out there ought to be excited. I have on the phone Ronnie Stoneman. Ronnie, say hello.
Well, hello to everyone. Yes. I'm proud to be here with y'all and all that kind of stuff.
Well,
know,
yeah.
I'm just proud.
You're just proud. You're just there, and you're just proud. Before we came on the air with Ronnie, I was telling her that I opened the show with a great tune from Mara O'Connell back in 1989. It was kind of a bluegrassy tune. Ronnie, the reason I picked it is called Can't Stop the Girl, but it had a lot of great players from Nashville, and Mara can belt them out, and that was several years ago. She did a great song, and then I followed it with Girls Breakdown from Alison Brown and Kristen Scott Benson. We had a number from her. As we've talked, you were the first female Scruggs-style banjo player, and I think we all agree that you were the first.
Yes, I guess the banjo is awfully heavy, and it's clumsy, you know, and it is very heavy. A good one is, you know, usually a good one is. I don't know nowadays they make too many good banjos, but I have a Gibson Master Tone Bowtie. I bought in 56. I bought it in Baltimore, Maryland, and Mr. Fred Walker, my brother Scott, took me down there, and we had a banjo with me that Daddy had made that we traded it in for the down payment. The banjo at that time was $800 that I bought, and I had to pay for it. I was not in the money. None of us ever was in the money. No Stoneman, as I knew in those days, was ever in the money.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had any money, some agent or booking agent or a manager usually took it off. So I guess that old saying goes, you never make any money if you're kind of a so-called artist until you die, you know, and then somebody else will collect artists.
Oh, I hear your dog. Something's up.
Do I?
I say, I hear your dog. Something's up down there.
Oh, yeah, my little doggie. Somebody came in the front door.
Okay. Well, then your dog's doing what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to let you know something's going on.
That's exactly right. And I love my little dog. She's a flood victim.
Oh.
I got her when the flood in Nashville.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was given that some people lost their house in the flood, and their dog was on a board. So they rescued it, and I got it.
Whoa.
Has a little dog.
Bless your heart. Bless your heart. Ronnie, yeah. Ronnie, we've talked three or four times in the last week, just kind of getting ready for today. And, you know, I know about the Stoneman Family Band. Everybody remembers you. And of course you've been around, you know, from Hee Haw and everything. And, so tell us a little bit about the Stoneman Family Band, in case they haven't done as much research as I've urged them to do. Tell a little bit about the Stoneman Family Band. You were playing in that band from just childhood on. Just tell a little, we'll talk a little bit about that for a minute.
There was a lot of us children. Mom and Dad liked each other a whole lot. So they became a whole big bunch of us. And there was 15 living of us that lived to be older, you know. But everybody played and sang because, you know, poor people, I'm talking about materialistic-wise, they are always more creative, seems like, because, you know, they are. They have nothing but creativity in their hearts, and it just seems because they have nothing else. And they make music in order to feed a part of their soul that's kind of saddened, and it really comes out as good music. But Daddy made all of our musical instruments, and he never told us to play or forced us to, and we never went to school for music. We did it, and there was five bands at one time within the family in different places.
Really? Now,
so
I did.
The Stoneman family, it just seems like they say, which one? But the one that came and took it to Nashville was Donna, Scott, Daddy, me, and Jimmy, and Mommy came with us. The others stayed in Maryland and Virginia, you know, to play for whatever they wanted to play for. They worked day jobs, you know, but the ones that came to Nashville, we were just mostly just dependent on our music to, you know, pull us through. And it was very hungry times. But when we did do well, our managers took it, so we still picked on. So we didn't pick just for the money. We played for our hearts and our souls and to the people. Because Daddy always said, you know, You can't play for yourself. You've got to watch the audience and give them what you think they want and work hard and get your harmony well and open your mouth and sing loud. That's what you do. And that's what I did. I remember so well when we won the contest at Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C., I think it was in 1946 or 47, 46 or whatever. And I remember going into the contest, into the Constitution Hall. They opened the doors and they said, "Oh, God, here comes the Stoneman." And I'll never forget how I ran down the hallway because it was slick and we had more room than we had in our house. And I.
How old were you then?
I think I was about 4 and a half.
My gosh.
About 4 and a half years old. As a matter of fact, the picture that people can see, which we did not, none of us, there's only 3 of us Stonemans left because we're an old family. But there's Donna, Patsy, and myself. And everybody put something on the website or TV, or not the TV, but the computer, might as well be a TV, but the computer, all about us, and half the time we don't even know where it came from.
There's great, Ronnie, there's great video on YouTube, and I always ask people to, you know, go ahead and search YouTube for the Stoneman Family Band, because I think there's some things from your TV show and there's hours and hours and hours of your appearances on video on YouTube. It's just really remarkable.
Well, people put it on there, because first thing when we was in California, we did the shindig, and they got that on there. I think it was Big Ball in Monterey or some such a thing as that, where we jumped over some dancers, and that was ago in the 60s.
Is that when you had your go-go boots on?
Yeah, me and Donna always wore them, because first thing, you can't wear tennis shoes on stage and jump around, because even dancing, you can't hardly use tennis shoes because your feet don't slide. You couldn't wear the high heels because it just wasn't fitting for us at that time to wear the real high heels, and you can't dance or clog in that. So we picked out the boots, and I think we got that idea. You know, we got a pair of boots, you know, go-go boots. That's what we wore, not cowboy boots at that time. It was go-go boots, and it zipped up the side. Some of them zipped up the back, but mostly they zipped up the side. But Donna has always been known for white go-go boots. And I have too, but my legs look like Minnie Mouse. But I didn't care. I just had fun. Donna would try to fix my hair before we go on stage, and she'd, "Ronnie, aren't you going to comb your hair and put some makeup on?" And I'd take my hand and lick it and stick it on top of my head and kind of wash my hair down. And I said, "But Donna, honey, I don't have to be pretty. You do." I said, "Not one place in the contract says that I had to be pretty." I said, "If I did, I'd have been fired before I even got there." So I was having more fun, you know, and it was so cute. Donna was so pretty and so talented. Doggone, she could play the mandolin. She was so good. And I admired her, and I just loved her with all my heart. And all the girls, the women, were jealous over Donna, in the audience even. And they would say things like, "She's not as pretty as I thought she was." I was in the ladies' room one time. We were playing somewhere. I went to the ladies' room, was in the stall, and I heard the lady say, "Oh, Donna, well, my husband thinks she's so cute, but I don't think she's as pretty in person as she is on television." And I come back and I say, "Donna, you don't do anything wrong or anything, but I was not the pretty one." But I said, "I'm not the pretty one, Donna, so I can flirt with their husbands while their wives are mad at you." We would have games and we would laugh.
Well, you seem like you were, you know what? I distracted you. We're talking about the contest that you were in and sliding on the floor and being 4 and a half. And then I kind of pulled you away from where I wanted you to go. Is that the time when you met Grandpa Jones?
Yes. But it was the time that I had not paid any attention to play, because I was in the fourth grade before I realized that everybody in the whole world didn't play music. So when I went sliding down that hall, because I just got a pair of new shoes, and Mama had made me and Donna a little steep sack dress, and as soon as they turned me loose, I went, "Oh, man, that's a place to slide." And my brother was in the Navy, and he sent us mommy money so she could buy us a pair of little patent leather slippers. So I had slick bottoms, and I went sliding down, and I looked over, and there was this guy gluing his eyebrows on in the dressing room, and he glued his mustache. I watched him, and I got in the room, and I pushed a chair up onto the dressing table, and there's big round bulbs all around the mirrors. And I crawled up on it, and I looked up in the face of this man, and I kept staring. I kept thinking to myself, why is he putting white stuff on his eyebrows and his mustache? And my mother said, Lord of mercy, where is Ronnie? And she was hunting for me because Mama came to play with Daddy and all of us. You know, she played the fiddle. And she said, where is Ronnie? And she said, get out of that room and quit bothering that old man. And Grandpa Jones said, Miss Stoneman, that's all right. You just go get your fiddle and tune up. I'll take care of her. So that was the first time I met Grandpa Jones. But I didn't know him as Grandpa Jones.
Right. You just knew him as a guy sitting there putting white stuff on his eyebrows and his mustache.
Yeah, that's all I cared about. I wanted to see what was going on there. So then he was there as a guest just to play a little bit. There was a fellow by the name of Connie B. Gay who was putting on the contest at Constitution Hall. And I think there was about 200 bands or so that we were against. And my brothers, my older brothers, wouldn't play with Daddy on this particular vendor because they said to Daddy, your music is too old and old-fashioned, and we got electric instruments, and we're going to play, and we're going to take the prize away from all the other bands. So that's when Daddy... Mama said, Ernest, we'll take the little ones and we'll go. So she get busy making their instruments. And every night we would practice on the front porch. The back porch had already fallen down because it was a piece of junk. And Daddy had just built the front porch. And it was painted a kind of a Pepto-Bismol pink because someone gave us the paint because we didn't have money to buy the paint. And it was like nowadays I think back it was that Pepto-Bismol pink. You know?
Well, it wasn't hard to find then, was it?
Oh no, it was somewhere the Pepto-Bismol torture and dog had just come by. Yeah, it's kind of funny.
That cracks me up.
Funny. Yeah, it was the truth. And so we practiced every night on that front porch, and people would come in, they'd be coming from Washington. And they would park up and down the road in front of our house, which was a dirt road. But they would park up and down, and they would have brand new cars and everything, and they would let their children get out and come in the house and run around with me because I was more interested in why are they coming to see us, because we lived in a one-room shack. It was a shack, and because it didn't have a roof on either. It had a canvas over the quarry roof. And that was until we won the contest. We won the contest, by the way.
Yeah.
At the Constitution Hall, we were on television, and we never saw one. But I remember first, my brothers went on first with about three bands prior to us, you know. And so I remember saying, well, they didn't get a good band at all, and I'm glad. I don't know why I thought that. So then it says, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the Stoneman. The Stoneman family, and we went walking up there, and everybody just standing there staring at us, and Daddy said for all of us children to sing loud due to the fact that there would be only one microphone. And needless to say, we sang loud, and we played as loud as they played as loud as they could. I just sang. And the song that he had picked for us to do on that particular night was Somebody's Waiting for Me. And that used to be our theme song all everywhere else we played. And it goes a little bit like this. Somebody's waiting for me. Someone loves me, I know. The light is shining bright in the window tonight. For there's somebody waiting there for me.
Oh, man.
It says, 'twas in a country garden when the sun was at its height. And all the joy in fun wine begins to flow. From a table in a corner, a young man slowly rose. And he said, it's getting late, boys, I must go. It's a song about his mother.
Oh.
She's my mother's sweetheart. She's the one I meant tonight. But you see, I told the truth, boys, when I said, And that was a song we did that time. Now, I'm 74, so it's been quite a many years ago.
Well, let me just tell you this. I think you did it really well.
Oh, we did. The audience, Mama took a break on that too, and she was upset with my brothers, my older brothers, because they were standing in the wings, and they were watching us. And some man in the audience hollered, "Swinger, Law, Swinger." And my brothers had little bibs overhauls on and skull hats and red scarves around their neck. And we won the prize, so that meant that we was on television about 62 weeks, I do believe that's what it was.
Ronnie, we talked about this last week. You were on TV, and I want you to tell a little bit what happened when Donna came home, but you actually won money from that TV appearance, that show, and you replaced your roof.
Very much what we did. We didn't. Daddy had to have the money because he was trying to, get money to put a roof on the house. So we won the contest, but then we didn't get paid very much, I'm sure. Just got it once a week on a Saturday night. And some girl, first the school authorities didn't want us going on, late. They would fuss and they were going to take us off the stage because they didn't want any of the children working. And I thought, what the cat hair is work mean? This is saying this ain't work. So, and everybody was fussing about it, but then they put us on first, so that was good. But Donna came home from school, and she said, "Daddy, what's a television?" And Daddy said, "Well, what do you want to know for?" And she said, "Well, some girl at school told me that she saw me on television Saturday night." She said, "What is a television?" And so Daddy said to Mama, he said, "Hattie, I'm taking the youngins up to Watkins Hardware Store, and he's got some televisions up there, and I'm going to show the youngins what a television is." So 12 of us went up there with him. And we all lined up, and there was about 4 or 5 men standing at the counter, just talking about the problems of the world and solving them. And they came in, they said, we all walked in with Daddy and behind him, and they all said, hi, Papa Stone, because they knew of us picking music and Daddy making our instruments, and he also worked during the day, and he worked on weekends sharpening saws, so he worked 3 jobs, and so Daddy said, "Mr. Watkins, I want to show the youngins, if it's all right with you, what a television is. Some youngins saw him on television Saturday night, and they want to know what it is." So he took us back there, and he had 5 old televisions, but they were real small pictures. The screen was small. And we all lined up, and we saw television. Not us. We just saw somebody on there, but we said, "Oh, that's the television." And that was all we needed, and we went home. That's all. It set our minds of what a television really was. So we went home, and Daddy started buying lumber. Every weekend, he'd put a few more boards up to that roof, and he finally got the roof done, and we were proud of that. Mm-hmm. And then we'd play restaurants, down at Armstrong's restaurant during on Saturday and sometimes Sunday after church. Daddy would take us over there, and then later on we started playing. Well, I was about 8 years old then, and he would have us go over to Morningside, Maryland, and play for a little radio station there. And he would take orange crates and stack them up so we could reach the microphones. But then we had sang songs, and he'd put all the shut-ins. Oh, I got kicked from that. Anyway, we had sang, and everybody would call in, "Aren't they little darlings and little talented children?" And my mother would roll her eyes. Mommy was so funny. She'd roll her eyes and go, "Yeah, like." And I'd hear her say, "Pray, say, dear God, in Jesus' name, help me to endure all my blessings."
Hey, look, when you were 8, were you playing a banjo when you were 8?
No, I didn't start till I was about 9 and a half.
Well, all right. Here's my question then. How did you get, were you playing with picks then or just your fingertips?
Well, Scott, my brother Scott, got me interested really in the Scruggs style type of picking because Daddy made my banjo, my first one. It was a real short neck on a little banjo mandolin, I guess, just a little, like a ukulele banjo. And he put a peg in, a fifth peg, and Scott would say, "Do your roll and keep it smooth." Yeah, it's the right hand, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And just do the low. And I would do it all the time in practice. Even in school, I would draw a line and pretend that there were strings. And I could hear it, even though, you know, I could hear the tone of each string and
wow.
what pitch it was in. And I would sit there and do it on the desk and roll my fingers. And then later on, I mean, people would say, here comes that old hillbilly that not needed hillbilly. So, and I would, didn't care. I just kept my fingers moving on that old banjo. I'd walk around carrying it like a, people with a doll, you know, and I just learned to play it. And then Scott says, it's time to, Daddy said, I'm going to make you another banjo. Now that one after I make you this one, the next one, you're going to have to buy it yourself. So he made me a regular size neck banjo because he carved the neck out and put it, the banjos together. And he said, now come and help me. He said, if you're going to play it, you might as well learn to put it back together and take it apart. So I went over to old stove. It was an oil stove. And big old tank on there, you know, just bubble, bubble. And he would turn on the burner and then put this, this glue. It was shaped, it was like a real thin paper, but it was yellow. And you melt it, and that's the glue he used. And it worked good. It really did do good. And I watched him and helped him. He made clamps. He handmade his own clamps, you know, for your whole thing. And he carved it all out, and we all played. And then after I played on that particular banjo, it wouldn't stay in tune very well. And I tuned all the time. And Daddy said, God blame it, every one of my youngins are the world's greatest tuners. I remember that. And then Scott said, it's time for you to get another banjo, Ronnie. We're going down to Fred Walker's place in Baltimore. So off we went with this handmade banjo Daddy made me. I'd give anything to have it.
Oh, on. Wouldn't you, though? Wouldn't you, though?
Oh, the Lord. If I could just have the first one and the second one.
Oh, wow.
But you don't know how valuable they are when you're using them, but all you care about is a better one, a real one that somebody had, you know. So we went to Fred Walker's.
How did you get, Ronnie, how did you get picks to fit your fingers? That's what I can't understand.
At first, I was using just my fingers, and then Scott said, you can't do that, Ronnie. You got to use picks. So he would work with them, and Daddy would work. Daddy worked with the picks to make them small enough to stay on my fingers.
Oh, okay, all right.
He looked and remodeled them, and he knew how to do everything.
All right. So you were going down to trade your banjo, and I interrupted you. But since I play a little bit of banjo, I couldn't figure out how you get them on your fingers being so young like that. But that answers that. But you were going to go trade it in.
Yeah, he designed them to fit my fingers, the little ones. He would get the real ones, and then he'd work at it.
Wow.
Well, and we went down to Fred Walker's, and Scott talked Mr. Fred Walker into allowing me to use that as a down payment. But then I would pay him every week, and I'd play the nightclubs. I learned to play pretty good, and Scott took me with him to play. And all my tip money that I'd get in the jar, you know, the tip, I got put down on my banjo. You know, I just paid it off with tip money from the skull orchards that I played.
Wow.
Bluegrass and country music was never in those days in real nice places. They were in the worst of places. And you worked hard, and Daddy would say, there'll be no drinking ever and no smoking on the stage. When my brothers would try to get a beer, take up their hands so angry.
What did you say? Skull Orchard? Is that what you said?
A Skull Orchard. That's the places you played in those days.
Okay.
We call them Skull Orchards, the old timers. They understood what it meant.
All right. Well, I thought that's what you said, but I wasn't quite. Obviously, I'm not an old timer in that sense because I didn't know what it meant.
Yeah. The young people today don't know what it is. I guess I better explain it.
Us crazy kids.
You go into a place and you can smell the tension, and you can practically feel that there are how many fights there's going to be that night. And Scott taught me that.
Oh.
He'd say, now, Ronnie, well, the first thing you do when you get a job ever, by yourself or any with the band, he said, always look for the nearest exit from the stage.
Good thinking.
He said, if there isn't any, look out where the bar is, and you can run under the bar.
Wow.
And hide. Because they really, the rough places, they didn't have lovely places like they have now. And the scholars were not interested in the bluegrass at that time. The scholars, you know, the professors and people in music in the university.
Right.
They did. We didn't notice that. I mean, if they were. And then we played, but I did remember a long time ago when we was up in New York playing the Tonight Show. This is the first time we ever realized, I guess, that anybody, you know, that would like our music, a real white man's jazz, I'll say,
sure,
bluegrass to us, and they were interested in us, and we didn't even know it. Honest to goodness, and this is the truth, the Stonemans were great musicians. I'm not saying it because it was my family, but they were marvelous. There's no one in the world today that could beat Scotty Stoneman on the fiddle, but he only went to the fourth grade. And he didn't learn much when he was there. He only went to the fourth grade. And he wanted to play music all the time. And he'd say, Ronnie, if you really want to learn, he said, you ought to pick it up first thing in the morning and lay it down last thing at night. And that's what he did. And he learned the fiddle from Grandpa, my mother's dad. See, in the mountains, a lot of people would hand it down, and their music is handed down from generation to generation. And then it just goes up. And the reason I learned all that myself is because I would listen carefully to some of the questions they asked us when we played UCLA and all that. You know, all the kids came over and had a workshop, and they would ask us questions and everything. So we get to thinking, wait a minute. But, you know, I remember when we played in New York, like I was saying, at the Tonight Show, and a limousine came to take us to this place, and we had two managers, and they took, I said, where are we going? I said, don't matter, just get in the car and get your banjo and get in the car. And I said, we got to ride in that ugly old car, and it was real long. So they said, yeah. I said, where are we going? He said, you'll see. So we get over there at this place, and we all get out. We even had our instruments on our neck. We went one thing to another. Still, instruments were not in the case. And then we go in, and it came to be the Juilliard School. We played for them. And it's so weird that many years ago, they came to our house in Comedy Hills with that one-room house, and we were all eating dinner, and four people from Washington, D.C. had told Daddy he would like to send the District of Columbia to pay for it for six of the Stoneman children to go to the Juilliard School.
Wow.
He said, we noted. He said, we tested them, and we noticed that they are not stylistic, but they always bring their instruments that you made, come to school, and write their own songs on the playground where everybody else played. They were sitting there picking their music and write songs. So Daddy asked all the family at that table, the old eating table with a bench on one side and Daddy's handmade chairs on the other, and we were eating dinner. We didn't have a place for them to sit down, and Mama apologized to them for that. But he said, Mr. Stoneman, we noticed your children are not stylistic, but we would like to send them all to the Juilliard School, and the District of Columbia was going to pay for it. And Daddy said, well, that's a mighty fine school, and I'm proud that you even asked us. And he said, but we're mighty fine. We're awful proud. And he looked down at his plate, and he looked over at all the kids, and he said, does any of y'all want to go to that Juilliard School in New York? It's a mighty fine school. And he said, you can learn a lot there. And we all stared at Scott. We looked over at Scott, and he was sitting on the left-hand side of Daddy in a chair, and he pushed his chair back from the table, and he thought a while, and he looked up, and he said, no, Pop, we want to stay here and help you feed us.
Mm.
And Daddy said, well, I don't reckon they want to go, do they?
Oh, my.
So they left, and then years later, we played the Juilliard School for the kids. But when I first realized that there was something going on in our music, was I was playing the famous Bar and Grill on 12th and York Avenue in Washington, D.C., and it was just a nightclub. It was not a free one. It was just a bar and grill, just like it said. And
but not a Skull Orchard.
Yes, it was.
It was a Skull Orchard, okay. That's going to be my... I'm going to use that term as much as I can the rest of the weekend, by the way.
Oh, the Skull Orchard.
Yeah.
Well, Jimmy Dean was during the time. He would play Skull Orchards, too. Right. As a matter of fact, Jimmy Dean played a place called the Bucket of Blood, and that was really also a Skull Orchard.
Yeah. Well, I interrupted you. You were playing at a place called Famous. Yeah, finish that story.
Yeah, playing at Famous, and we were playing. We started our first show about 9 o'clock, 8 or 9 o'clock. Most time, I think it was 9. And I noticed when we did our first shows, I noticed on my right hand side. I was on the right hand side of the stage. It was up high, and a little teeny dance floor where people would try to dance, but they were too drunk to dance sometimes. But it wasn't a big dance floor. But I looked over to my right, and I'm down on the floor, and there was this round table, and there was about 5 or 6 men there, and they seemed different. And I got to watching them. I'm thinking, they're not like the rest of this, and they're not like us. So I got, when we took a break, we had 15-minute breaks, and we did 5 shows a night, 15-minute breaks. And I think I made $56 a week.
Wow.
And 6 nights a week, and we played 5 shows a night. And, but anyway, I got off the stage, and I walked over, and I said, "Where are y'all from?" I said it to one of the fellas. He said, "Oh, we're from Georgetown." I said, "Oh," and I didn't know exactly where Georgetown was at that time, because I was just playing. I was just getting up every morning and breathing and having, you know, learning more on the banjo and such as that. But I said, "Well, I noticed they didn't have any much to drink on the table, but I said, why are y'all here in this place?" I swear I said that. "Why are y'all here in this place?" And he said, "Well, we are professors from Georgetown University." And I said, "Oh, y'all teach or something?" He said, "Yeah, we're professors." And then he said, "We're here to listen to you all because you're great." And I said, "We are." And he said, "Yeah, we're here because your culture and your music is phenomenal. And we like to watch you." And they came, that's when I first started noticing our clientele and our audiences were different.
A little different, huh?
Different. Then tomorrow, "Hey, play your show, yeah, we were here at the time," you know, or some such a thing. But these people were gentlemen, and I went, "Oh, okay." I said, "We'll play for you then." And I got back on the stage.
You know what just came out in that voice just then, don't you? That was the ironing board lady, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, there's this, "Hey, play there. Good grief, I said, he's going to fall flat on his face in a minute. But no, the ironing board lady is that right? It's like that.
Okay.
"Where's the fire slaughter?"
You know what? I wanted to ask you. We talked about this last week a little bit, but your time on Hee Haw. How old were you when you started on Hee Haw? Do you remember that?
Well, I had 4 youngins then.
Oh.
I had five. I had 5 children then when I started, because I was married at 16. Like, duh, you know, stupid. I was sitting with Mom, and she said, I said, "But Ma, he loves me." She said, "You're funny, he loves you." But I didn't pay any attention, so I had to go step in it right up to my neck. And I did. And I learned, but boy, that road of learning, that educational program, the way I did, was not fun. And I'd like to tell all the young girls out there, just because they say, "I love you," doesn't mean they're going to support you.
That's right. That's right. Well, how did you get on Hee Haw? And we're skipping ahead a bit, but since you did that voice, it made me think of, and you told me on the phone about, you know, you saw an ad for something for the ironing board lady, and tell us a little bit about your stint on Hee Haw, please.
Okay. I heard that they was giving out news out that they wanted a lady to do a mountain woman. And so I heard that through this writer, one of the writers of the song, of the Hee Haw. And I went to their manager, and I asked him, our manager at that time, of the Stoneman, and I said, "Bobby, can I go down and try out for that part on Hee Haw?" And he said, "No, you can't." He said, "If they don't take the whole family, they don't take you." And I said, "Well, it's not going to interfere. I can go down and do some..." They said something about a reading. I don't know what that is, but I can sure learn it. And he said, "No." I said, "Well, when do we go back on the road? Because they would beat our brains out on that highway." He was doing good. We did really well, you know. And he said, "You got to take the whole family." And I thought, "Well, when do we go back to playing on the road?" He said, "This is the first time that y'all have 10 days off. And I looked at him as I got off the bus, and I looked at him, and I said, consider it my 10 days as a notice. Mm. Now, I didn't. I gave my notice.
You left the band.
And I left my brothers and sisters.
Oh, my.
Because, I'll tell you, and that was the saddest day of my life. But when I, but when he, the managers were taking our money. They were not giving us enough money to even live on, no matter how many show dates we did on the road. It didn't matter to them. They wanted to push us as hard as they could and then just give us a weekly salary, which that's what we thought that that would help promote us. We didn't know. And they had us to sign an 8-year power of attorney for our finances and to take care of them for us.
You should have called me first. Should have called me first, Ronnie.
I know that, honey. I didn't. We didn't know. It was, you know, we had won the vocal group of the year in 1967 for the CMA, and that's when they and we were nominated for the vocal group, and we won. And there was five, and 5 years straight we were nominated as the instrumental group.
Wow.
5 years straight in a row. So wow. We were good with our job, with our craft, as they say. We knew how to play, but our managers took our monies and gave us a little bit each week to live on, and it wasn't enough living. You know, I didn't have enough money to support children because my husband at that time didn't work. He wouldn't. And so I was just struggling along, you know, and I thought, well, I got these children, and I have a special child with epilepsy. And I thought, well, this is the right thing to do due to the fact that, you know, he said, the manager said, well, you people will spend it on things you don't need, anything that begin with A, like a house, a car, you know. Can you believe I remember
a meal?
So well? A house, a car.
A lunch?
Anything that begin with A, like
oh,
a
man.
House, a car. And I'm going, and he said, look, and this will invest your money for you. We'll take all this money and invest for you, and after the train, the gravy train is over, then you'll have something to have. You'll have that money built up. So I thought it was a good idea, but I didn't know how long he was talking about. But anyway, I signed the papers, and needless to say, they took all our money.
So how long were you on? So you tried out for Hee Haw. You did a reading. How long were you on this show?
I was on there about 22 years. You know, the 22 years I was on. Hee Haw was 25 years old. And
that's
it was
right.
But when I first went on there, they said they wanted a mountain woman. So when I went down to read, I was married to a school principal for that time, and he was always telling me how to talk and how to do things. And when I got down there, you know, it was the opposite of what he was teaching. They wanted somebody really a mountain woman, which I could do very well, thank you. I thought, well, that's... And then I said, I didn't understand what it was, so I went home. They didn't call me back. And I went home and I prayed. I got in the closet. I got on my knees and I prayed. And tears streaming down my face. And 3 days later, they called me back.
Wow.
And they told me not to bring my husband at that time. They said, don't bring your husband, because he was controlling me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, just come down by yourself and we'll pretend that we need to talk to your husband, but we won't get around to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got on. We went into this room with Gordy, and Gordy Papp, he was played my husband. And he said, now we want a rough talking woman. And I said, oh, you mean like Marjorie Main, Ma Kettle?
Mm-hmm.
I said, I do her all the time. Now, this is the God's truth, what I said. I know how to do her. Because I used that voice in all the skull orchards we played in Washington, D.C. to break up fights.
See, that skull orchard talk came in handy.
I know. I mocked her. I used to mimic her all the time. And Mama would say, now, Ronnie, you ain't supposed to talk like that. And I'd go, oh, get in here. And it's so easy, you know, because I used to be on the stage and I'd tell the people, damn, blame it, quit the fighting, you know, and I'd bring out the mic, and they would stop and laugh.
Oh, my.
And I thought, that's pretty cool. So when I went down to Hee Haw, I used that voice. I remember there was one there that the first one had me read, and I said, he'd say, I'd read, where's the fly swatter? And I said, I said, Laverne, where's the prize water? And he said, I don't know, I'd leave. Last time I seen it, you strained the tea with it. And that was the first line, and then the second line we had was, everything that I am, I owe to my mother. My mother saw it, and she said, Lord have mercy, I do believe I'm going to faint. I said, but Mommy, this is a good part. Mommy, you don't understand. It wasn't, needless to say, it wasn't low cut. I wore my bra backwards, but it fit. But on the other hand, I was fun to dance with.
Oh, Ronnie, listen, I love you so much. I'm having such a good time. And we talked at length last week about what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. And we've agreed, haven't we? You're going to come back and do some more of this, right?
Oh, yeah. You
get
rid of me, eh? I'm
fine. No. I told you I wouldn't keep you more than a half an hour and a half. So we're right at about 45 minutes, but we're going to continue this. We're going to talk about when we're going to come back on. We have so much more to talk about. I love you so much. I know that the listeners are just.
I love you all to death, and I love you too. And I love you good. That means I'm not after anything except that I just downright love you to death.
Well,
Bluegrass fan.
Oh yeah, they love you. There's a chat room associated with Worldwide Bluegrass, and I'm telling you, there are people they're enjoying every second of it, and I know the listeners are. And I wanted to tell you one more time. Remember, remind them again the address to get your book Pressing On. Now you sent me mine. I sent you my check for $23, and yes. I think this is a great idea. They still have time, don't they, to mail in a check to you and get it back for Christmas?
Yes. Go ahead and mail it if they want one. I think they'll find it. It was rated number 5 in Amazon, so it's not a crummy book.
Yeah, well,
it's a good book. It's all true.
I'm sure it is. You want to give them your address so they can mail down to you and you can sign it for them? You want to give that out?
Yeah, you can always talk, and I don't have it in front of me. We just got a new post office box.
All right, I got it. Hold on, let me find that note. I got notes all over my place here. All right, here we go. This is the address, the post office box. Ronnie Stoneman. Mm-hmm. The post office box is 14-0348. That's Nashville, Tennessee, and the zip code is 37214. And for $23, a check or money order to Ronnie at that address, again, post office box 14-0348, Nashville, Tennessee, 37214. She will sign her book, Pressing On, and send it back to you. And I think they'll get it in time for Christmas. I mean, what a great gift for a music fan.
Right, that's for sure.
Oh yeah.
Hopefully they'll get it in time. If not, just get it for yourself and not for presents.
That's right. That's right. Ronnie, I have enjoyed this so much now. And you and I are talking, and we're going to talk further about you coming up here and visiting, right?
Yeah, I want to come up and take and grand with you guys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We can just pick together.
We'll work on that. We got all kinds of things, Ronnie. We got more things going on than these people would believe. But we're going to get some sit and talk with some kids and do some stuff. It's all going to work. We're all going to make it work next year, just like you and I talked, okay?
I wanted to teach some little youngins how to play banjo, and I know how to play guitar and also bass fiddle, and if they want to learn that, I could, I'd spend some time with them.
Yeah.
I love y'all, and thank you so much.
Ronnie, bless your heart. Have a Merry Christmas if I don't talk to you before then, okay?
Okay, Steve. I'll see you later.
All righty, bye.
Bye, hon.
I love that lady. I just don't, we talked last week. She's gone now and she'll come back again and we'll probably talk this week. We might get her back on before Christmas, but it's clearly we need more than one opportunity to talk to Ronnie. We're going to get her back again, but we had conversations last week that lasted so much longer and so many things. And it's all that same, you get that same feeling from talking to Ronnie that there's so much that's happened and she just has a tremendous attitude and always has that wonderful sense of humor gosh, what a treat. What a treat. I hope you enjoyed Ronnie Stoneman of the Stoneman Family Band in her own right, famous in her own right. What a remarkable lady. My book is on the way. I sent her a check already for my $23 to that address, and I'm going to stalk the letter carrier, as they call them now, until I get mine. But gosh, what's so much fun.